All right, let's bring it back in. Heard some really great discussion going on out there. Everybody loves a good wedding tradition, right? I don't know if you know this, but cultures across the globe have wild and unique ways of ceremonially tying the knot. Whether it's smashing porcelain jars in Germany, or the best man actually giving the groom a shave in Greece on the morning of the wedding. That's a lot of trust you're putting in somebody. The money dance in Mexico, or the awkward bouquet slash garter toss here in the States. Some of these things are really sweet and thought-provoking. Others are kind of cringy and painful to watch for everyone involved, but we do them. And at the heart of all of these traditions is the same idea, celebrating the promise of love and commitment between two people, right? And throughout this series, we've talked about how studies show that although dating and romance have become more and more complex in our culture, the desire, actually, for commitment and for love has never been stronger. And just like any good economically minded society, we have found a lot of ways to capitalize on that. The wedding industry in the U.S. alone is estimated at over $66 billion a year. In 2025, the average wedding costs between $32,000 and $36,000 in the U.S., between $28,000 and $40,000 in Texas, and between $32,000 and $39,000 in major cities like Dallas or Houston. So good thing we don't live there, right? The average wedding dress in the U.S. costs between $1,500 and $2,500. The average engagement ring, the shiny little rock that starts the whole thing, it costs $5,200 to $5,500. And the average venue costs $7,500 to $10,000 in Texas. Now, why do I throw all these big scary numbers and dollar signs at you? Is it to scare you away from marriage? No. Well, maybe. No. I point all this out because you can learn a lot about people and society by watching where we spend our money, right? And Matthew 6:21 tells us, where your treasure, your wealth, your money is, there your heart will be also. And yet the painful reality is that although weddings are a multi-billion dollar industry, the statistics show that in 2025, about 39 to 42% of marriages ended in divorce, usually at the 7 or 8 year mark on average. Casey and I are about to hit 8 years this summer, so pray for us. Apparently that's a big rough year. But just in case anyone's thinking, well, yeah, Dane, sometimes things don't work out the first time. Sometimes you get married too young. Sometimes there's complications. Sometimes, like, you got to get a do-over. Sometimes that is true. But statistically, divorce rates almost double for second and third marriages, moving to 60 to 75% ending in divorce. Also interesting is that prenuptial agreements, right, these discussions, these contracts you make before entering into marriage of this is what I'm bringing in, and if this thing ends, this is what I'm taking out, they have become far more common today, especially among millennials and Gen Z. So that is all of us in this room, our generation, with 40 to 50% of couples seeing this as a regular, proactive next step. And what's fascinating is that this is being largely driven by men because in 2025, 69 to 75% of all divorces were initiated by the woman. We can all see something doesn't match up here. Thousands of dollars spent on weddings, billions every year, yet over a third will end before they even hit double digits. Now, these statistics do get better for believers, right? For those who are regularly engaged with their faith in a church community, they lower to about 25%. So good, but that's still one out of four marriages ending in divorce. Clearly, something is breaking down after the long walk down the aisle. Something is happening that changes I do to I just can't anymore. Statistics show that the top reasons for divorce in 2025 were first, lack of commitment. And that can include the inability or the unwillingness to work on the relationship when they realize there's problems. They just give up. That's 73% to 75%. Infidelity and trust issues came in at a second with 55% to 60%. And this isn't just physical affairs, but emotional as well. And the study that was pointing this out found that actually social media was the primary driver of affairs in 2025. Constant conflict and arguing is also a big one, 55% to 57%. That makes sense in correlation with the lack of commitment, that if you're not able to talk about the conflicts as you have them, that's a big problem. And lastly, financial stress at 20 to 40%. All said these were common factors in divorces in the last year. And that's really tragic, right? But what's more tragic to me is that behind these reasons, none of them are inevitable or unavoidable. None of these issues are things that cannot be overcome. And it shows that although we may love to celebrate marriage on the wedding day, on its prettiest, most glorious day, rarely do we want to fight for it when things get hard, when they get messy, when they get painful. We have allowed our personal expectations and ideas of what we think we deserve to define the meaning of marriage in our world today. Expectations that are set by culture, by our family, by ourselves, that marriage will be the end of our loneliness, that finally all of our sexual desires will be fulfilled, that getting married will ease our financial struggles. And when these expectations eventually fail us, we become disillusioned, and we hunker down and we fight for our rights, we claw for control, until eventually something breaks and we give up. It's a scary thing walking down the aisle now, because everyone who gets married makes the same vows, to love and honor each other until the day they die. And yet every couple who ever got divorced made those same promises one time. These days, walking down the aisle can seem like a 50-50 shot. But what if there were a better way? What would it look like to walk down the aisle and not wonder if it's going to be forever or if it's going to go down in flames? What if marriage was about more than a contract? What if we could walk down the aisle not with fear or anxiety, but with boldness, joy, and courage again? Tonight, we're going to look at a picture of this kind of marriage, a marriage full of promise and purpose. Turn with me to the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon, in your Bibles or on your phone, starting in chapter 3. And as you turn there, last time we covered the first half of chapter 3, right? We talked about this dream sequence where the young woman describes her physical desire for intimacy with her love. That because he's a man of proven character, because he is gentle in how he cares for her, because he's clear in his communication with her, she feels safe with him emotionally and is therefore ready to be with him physically. So in this dream, she's searching through the streets until she finds him. She grabs hold of him and she whisks him away to her mother's house, which is surprising. But again, this is one last check to make sure that she isn't getting caught up in her passion, but that this man is truly one who loves her for who God made her to be, not just for her body. And we ended with the second plea in verse 5 of chapter 3 that says, "I admonish you, O maidens of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the young does of the open fields, do not awaken or arouse love until it pleases." So now tonight, we pick up in verse 6. It says, "Who is this coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke, like a fragrant billow of myrrh and frankincense, every kind of fragrant powder of the traveling merchants? Look, it's Solomon's portable couch." Who's that girl? It's not a girl. It's Solomon. The time of waiting has come and gone. Solomon is approaching, and he is coming in hot, right? He isn't just taking his time. He isn't leisurely walking up the path while distractedly looking at his phone. No one's having to drag or urge him to come. He is moving so fast that from a distance, you can see him coming because he's kicking up dust in his wake. He is excited, he is eager, and he is moving with purpose. Not only that, we'll see in the next verse that he isn't approaching alone. He's coming with an entourage, with his crew. He's got his boys in tow with him, and this is important for reasons we'll discuss in a minute. But before that, I want us to look at the language that's used to describe his approach. What does she depict it as? She says, like a column of smoke. Now, she isn't just saying, yeah, man, they came in all crazy and wild, and they were kicking up dust everywhere, and it was a mess. That's not what's happening here. This is actually an incredibly significant and intentional phrase. Where else in the Old Testament can you think where we hear a reference to a column or pillar of smoke? It's in the book of Exodus. Exodus 13 describes how God will guide his people to the promised land as they traverse this harsh desert. In verse 20, it says, they journeyed from Succoth and camped in Etham on the edge of the desert. Now the Lord was going before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them in the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel by either day or night. And he did not remove the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So Exodus, right, is the story about how God used a man named Moses to set his people free from generations of slavery in Egypt. God promised them that he would bless them, that he would protect them, that he would lead them to a new promised land, to a new land where they can flourish beyond their wildest imagination. And to get there, they had to traverse, had to cross this harsh wilderness. And because they didn't have Google Maps, and because Waze would probably have gotten them into a wreck, God was a little more creative, and he manifests himself in the form of a column of smoke during the day that stayed ever on the horizon. He was always guiding his people towards life, towards flourishing. And this is the image that she uses to compare the approach of Solomon. That here in this first verse, she is setting the tone for how their marriage will be defined. Now, what she's not saying is that he's setting her free from the captivity of singleness. She's not equating singleness with Egypt and marriage with the promised land. That's not the image. What she is saying is that this is a man who leads like God. That she is willing to follow after him, not because he is a man, but because he is a godly man, because he is coming with God's heart for her. He is coming with the purpose of leading her to a place where she can flourish to her maximum potential. She actually uses temple imagery in this passage to show us that marriage is a holy reflection of God's commitment to us. She describes Solomon's arrival like a fragrant billow of myrrh and frankincense, like every kind of fragrant powder of the traveling merchants. Fellas, take notes. The dude's cologne game was on point. Yes, but also there's a deeper meaning to this. She notes the smell of myrrh and frankincense specifically. These fragrances held really deep, significant meaning in the Old Testament. Frankincense was this kind of white, yellowish resin that was used to represent holiness and divinity. It was often used by priests when people would come to the temple to pray. Myrrh was a more like reddish resin, and it symbolized suffering, affliction, and mortality. And this was something they often used during purification rituals. When people would confess their sin, they would use this on the offering, and it would bring up this aroma to say, your offering has been accepted on your behalf. One of the things that Solomon is most known for is building the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. It was this grand creation that became the heart and hub of religious and cultural life for God's people. And as God gave Solomon the instructions for how to build the temple, he didn't just include the building instructions, but also experiential instructions as well. He said, use these sweet fragrances when people enter the temple, because I want them to smell something sweet. Why? Well, because science shows, we know, that smell is the closest sense linked to memory. God says, when people smell something sweet and pleasant, I want them to remember me, to remember walking in relationship with me, that living in a covenant, in a committed relationship with me is something sweet and good. These fragrances are also associated with Jesus, used for his anointing as both king and sacrifice by the wise men when they show up. So these fragrances, using these to describe Solomon, they are a subtle yet powerful picture of what marriage is. It is divine. It is something that was appointed and made possible by God. It involves suffering and sacrifice of ourselves. Yet it is sweet and it is good. That suffering is not pointless, but produces flourishing for another. Now make no mistake, marriage is not about our happiness or our fulfillment. Marriage is a promise to your spouse that you will die every day to yourself so that they can live better under God. This is what we see reflected here in this couple. She doesn't see marriage as a contract. A contract is a conditional agreement, right? If you do blank, then I will blank. If you do not do blank, then I will not do blank. That's not marriage. Marriage says, I will, whether you do or don't. Marriage says, I will, especially when you don't. She doesn't see marriage as a system of societal domination or control either. She is excited about this moment. She describes the approach of her betrothed as a reminder of the intimacy with God that she was made for. She says that this guy is godly, and so is this thing that we are about to enter into. She understands that marriage is God ordained, not man made. Reflecting on this idea, one author wrote, from Jesus' perspective, not to mention the rest of the biblical witness, marriage isn't a contract. It is first and foremost a calling. Rather than an institution, it's an invitation. As such, marriage isn't a means for self-actualization or self-gratification, right? It's not about my fulfillment. Neither is it a reward for religious fervor or the culmination of one's life journey. It's not something God owes me if I follow him. Instead, marriage is a kingdom event, one in which we are routinely summoned to surrender ourselves for the sake of the other. Marriage isn't about satisfying my desires through you. It's about surrendering my desires for you, to build you up with everything that I have. Because that is what God has done for us. And that's a really hard calling. That is not an easy thing, which is why it cannot be done alone. In verses 7 and 8, we see a reference to the role that community plays in marriage. Starting in verse 7, it says, look, it's Solomon's portable couch. It's surrounded by 60 warriors, some of Israel's mightiest warriors. All of them are skilled with the sword, well-trained in the art of warfare. Each has his sword at his side to guard against the terrors of the night. So what's going on here? Remember, this is a poetic book. It's using lots of imagery to symbolize different things. So what's happening is this is an allusion, it is a reference to Solomon's dad, King David, right? Other than Solomon, David's probably the most well-known and celebrated king in the Old Testament. And among many other things, David was known to be a prolific warrior and military strategist. And he had this elite group of soldiers that would go with him into battle and into the various things that he did. It was a group called the 30. All right, these guys were like SEAL Team 6 meets the Avengers. Like, they're really tough dudes. Best of the best. Here, she describes Solomon as being surrounded by 60. That's double what David had, right? Even a political science major like myself can do that math, okay? This is a picture of the safety that she feels with Solomon. That he is strong and powerful, right? He is the king. He is a person of might and ability. And yet he uses that power not to dominate or control, but to protect her. Now, let me say something about strength. I know as soon as I said that, some of you immediately began to tune out or to roll your eyes or to feel your heart sink a little bit. Maybe you were thinking, all right, here we go. Here comes the to be a man speech, or here comes the to be tough, you gotta be tough speech, or you gotta go to the gym and you gotta work out speech. If that's you, I invite you to just, hey, take a breath, come back. That's not where we're going here tonight. There are many different kinds of power and strength. Ecclesiastes 7, which was also written by Solomon much later in his life, in verse 17, he says, wisdom makes one wise person more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. You don't have to have an impressive bench max or washboard abs to be a strong leader. Even having those things doesn't necessarily make you a strong leader. Casey told me that when we first met and started working together, she thought I was just a dumb meathead. Her words, okay? She denies that now, but I remember that kind of stuff sticks with you a little bit. The heart behind this picture of strength is confidence, competence, and courage. Confidence, competence, and courage. The 60 mightiest warriors, Israel's finest, that she references to, this is the confidence aspect, that you know who you are and what you bring into the marriage. She also says all of them are skilled with the sword. They're well-trained. They're competent. That you know how to leverage what you bring for the maximum benefit of your spouse. And so they have a sword at their side to guard against the terrors of the night. There's courage, that you're willing to do the hard work that needs to be done so that your spouse can flourish and thrive. And what's beautiful about this, what's great about this, is it applies to both husbands and wives equally. Strength of character trumps physical prowess every time, that I am safe with you, that I can trust you, I can depend on you, that I don't have to be afraid that you're just using me for my body or my money or my status, that I can be vulnerable and known with you, I can confess to you, confide in you, cry with you, and not fear being rejected or shamed. There is a side to me that nobody else gets to see but my wife. There are things that we know about each other that very few other people know. We have helped each other carry certain wounds, certain fears, failures, regrets that no one else gets to touch because there is a unique safety in our marriage. And if you get married, let me tell you, that is what you want. You don't want a marriage that is built on keeping up appearances. You don't want a marriage where it isn't safe to make mistakes or to confess sin, where grace and forgiveness don't exist, where you live under this constant pressure to be perfect. That will destroy you both. What we get here is this picture that is a reminder that at the same time, you are not alone. You are not alone. When they leave the wedding, Solomon's 60 men become their 60 men, right? The bride and groom are literally surrounded by community, ready to defend them from anything that would threaten to tear them apart. This is why it's so important that you maintain close relationships outside of just your marriage. It is far too common for newlyweds to get married and then just like drop off the face of the earth, right? Leaving all of their friends in the dust. Like, whatever happened to them? Don't know. They got married. Guess they died. Like, I don't know what happened. This is a very real thing that happens. And yet, Yet we were built for community, both at the micro level and at the macro level. It is not healthy for your spouse to be your only friend. They can be your best friend. That's great. That's good. But only friend is a problem. Because what happens when there's conflict? Who do you go to when you need wise counsel about how to deal with your spouse, how to navigate a conversation with them? What if you need someone to lean on because your spouse has sinned or is actively sinning against you and it hurts you and you don't know how to bring that up or deal with that? We need other brothers and sisters around us who can support us and remind us of the vows that we took on our wedding day. We also need our brothers and sisters around us to remind us that the world is not only about us, that other people exist and they have very real problems and joys that need to be shared in. We need both married friends and single friends in our lives. Some of the best marriage advice that I have gotten has been from my single friends because they aren't dragging their own marital baggage into it. Sometimes when you're married and you get together with other married couples and you talk about some of the struggles you're having, it kind of just becomes like a gripe session. You're like, this is not constructive. This is not helpful. We're talking about like the things our wives do that annoy us. And that's like, I feel seen, but what do I do about that? But my single friends, they don't do that. They just point me back to God's word. They point me back to the vows that I made, to the commitments that I made before the God of the universe, our families, and about 100 other people. We also get the opportunity to remind our single friends that marriage isn't the answer to all of our longing. Casey and I have been married for 7 years, almost eight. It's a very healthy marriage. I think we're arguably better than we've ever been. But that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of times where either she or I or both of us feel very alone in our marriage. That doesn't mean that we don't struggle financially just because we have two incomes and someone to share the bills with. Guess what? Different people have different spending habits. You think having a spouse will alleviate your financial struggles because you're doubling your income? I mean, it might help. But it also might add some expenses you didn't even know existed. Fellas, have you seen how much a woman's hair appointment is? It is robbery, I swear. It is like, it's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. We get our hairs cut for like a nickel, and it's like half a fortune for them to go get a simple haircut. It's crazy. That's what the world charges them. We need to fix that. It's wild. Amen. Ladies, at some point, he's going to buy something really stupid, okay? Or he's going to get really, really aggressive about saving for some reason, and you're not really going to know why. You won't understand it. He probably won't understand it, but it's going to bring him a lot of joy, but it's going to cause some tension in the relationship. It doesn't fix all the problems financially, I promise you. Our need for community is just as important in marriage as it is in singleness. Because we don't know what we don't know. We need others to be prepared to help us navigate marriage together in community. The last thing we see is that marriage takes intentionality. In the last couple of verses from chapter 3, the young maiden describes Solomon's appearance when he finally arrives to whisk her away. In verse 9, it says, King Solomon made a sedan chair for himself of wood imported from Lebanon. Its posts were made of silver, its back was made of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple wool, its interior was inlaid with leather by the maidens of Jerusalem. So Solomon arrives, plume of smoke shows up on her doorstep with his crew in tow, but he's not on foot. He's being carried in this beautifully ornate sedan chair. I tried to find a picture of what this looked like. There weren't really any good ones. But at the closing of this chapter, what's going to happen for them culturally is that the bride, she's going to go on this long description of the intricacies of this chair is what we're about to see. Now, that's not just because she was like super into ancient furniture design and she just really wanted people for forever to know about this. But it's because of what that chair symbolized in their society. today, when we attend a wedding, right, we get an invitation and it's to some like pristine, nice venue, either at a church or far off somewhere else, somewhere of, you know, symbolism or significance, or that's just really cute. Back then, the wedding would actually take place at the bride's house. The groom and his people, they would show up. The wedding ceremony happens at the bride's house. Afterwards, the bride and groom would return to the groom's house or the groom's father's house for their honeymoon and to build the rest of their lives going forward. Rather than make the couple walk the dusty journey in their fine wedding attire, they would be carried on these beautifully ornate chairs or couches as a token of honor so that they could make that journey in comfort, right? But Solomon doesn't just arrive with any chair, okay? He isn't just in some lazy boy that he had laying around. There's not like springs coming out of the thing and stuffing dropping behind him. That's not what's happening. In verse 9, it actually tells us Solomon made this chair himself. The chair is a depiction of the level of intentionality that Solomon is investing in their marriage. It's custom made from the finest materials available. She talks about this imported wood from Lebanon. This wood at that time was rarely, if ever, used for something as commonplace as weddings. It was usually reserved for things of the highest honor, like the construction of the temple, for the building of great palaces, to use in great ships that would take you across the ocean. Sometimes it was used in royal coffins. It was used for high status because the wood was known for its longevity and its strength. That wood ain't breaking, no matter the pressure that's applied to it. Then she goes on to describe the posts of silver and the back of gold. Let me ask you, what are the most basic components of a chair? You need four legs and like a frame, right? If you don't have that, I don't know what you got, but it ain't a chair. Solomon doesn't use gold and silver at the end to be decorative. No, he uses these precious metals for the most basic foundational components. He's sparing no expense in preparing this thing for himself and his bride. The seat, she talks about, was upholstered with purple wool. For them at that time, that would have been like mind-blowing. Purple dye at that time was incredibly rare and very expensive because it was very, very hard to get it. It was harvested from these tiny little seashells in this one specific region at one specific time of the year. It was a lot of painstaking work to get the stuff you would use to make a purple dye. So purple clothes were exclusively worn by kings, officials, and the ultra wealthy as a symbol of their prominence and authority. This dude goes and uses the dye in the seat where their bottom's gonna go, right? He's sparing no expense, and he's saying, this isn't the thing that matters. You are what matters. My money, my wealth, my whatever is meant to uplift and elevate you. And she ends by talking about how the interior was inlaid with leather. So it was comfortable. It was safe. Maybe it was a lazy boy. I don't know. But do you see the picture here? Do you understand the point that's trying to be made underneath all of that description? Something like that, a creation like that, doesn't just happen. It takes immense planning and intentionality and focus. The attention to detail in this chair was rivaled only by the construction of the temple. Every aspect of this chair was meticulously chosen and crafted to communicate one message, that I am leveraging everything that I have for you. My wealth, my power, my status, my abilities, my energy, my thought, all of it so that you may be honored, that you may be uplifted and elevated. That is the heart that he is walking into marriage with. Not the idea that I'm the prize. No, you are the prize. That my satisfaction isn't my priority. Yours is, that I am loving, I am safe, I am for you with everything that I am. So she rightly responds with joy and adoration in verse 11, she says, come out, gaze upon my beloved on our wedding day. So as the band comes back up, I actually want to take us back to the beginning. There's nothing wrong with celebrating a wedding, right? It's good and it is right to be happy for your friends or for yourself on that day. There's nothing bad about getting all dressed up and looking your best with your friends and having a party. I don't recommend going into debt over it. I don't recommend doing things just because it's popular or fancy. Make sure that you're celebrating in marriage, that it isn't just the wedding day, but that it's the promise of every day after that. That after the music fades, after the toasts and the speeches are done, when the wedding celebration ends and the actual marriage begins, that you'll remember marriage is a holy event. It isn't some flippant thing to be entered into lightly. It isn't a cure for loneliness, and it isn't the Christian answer to sexual desire. God made marriage as a picture of his own commitment to us. And when God makes a promise, y'all, he never breaks it. He doesn't back out on it. He doesn't forget it, no matter if we deserve it or not. He never gives up on us, never turns his back. Now, some of you in the room tonight, you're struggling with this message and these ideas because you have hopes, you have dreams, you have desires, things that you have prayed for a long, long time that haven't come to pass. You're so desperately ready to experience what we've talked about here in marriage tonight. If that's you, I just want to encourage you. Matthew 7:11 tells us, if you then, although you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Now, that's not a promise that you'll get whatever you want if you're faithful to God. God isn't a cosmic genie. He's not a slot machine where if you get the combination just right, he has to pay out. No, it is a promise that God doesn't give bad gifts to his kids. So if he hasn't given you the gift of marriage right now, that doesn't mean necessarily that you've done something wrong. It just means that he wants to show you how committed he is to you in a different way right now. Marriage is a unique picture of God's love, but it isn't the only one. You can still enjoy that deep safety, that commitment, that devotion and love, because that kind of unconditional, reckless love is found only in Jesus. All of our longing is ultimately a reflection of our longing to be with our Creator King again, with the one who left a throne not made of silver and gold and purple, but made of God's divine presence itself. That he left all of that to walk in the dirt and the dust with you and with me so that we could be elevated, so that we could be drawn back into the safety of God's never-ending love. A love that no height, nor depth, nor pain, nor loneliness, nor longing can ever separate us from. A love that knows no limits, no bounds. That is the love that we are so desperately seeking. And we can still experience that today. So I want to invite us tonight. Let's stand and thank God as we close for his commitment to us.